From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, filmmakers and brothers Chris and Paul Weitz. They went from directing the teen comedy American Pie, about a group of high school boys out to lose their virginity, to directing the new sophisticated comedy about a boy, adapted from the novel by Nick Hornby, who also wrote High Fidelity. The brothers say their approach on About a Boy was inspired by the comedies of Billy Wilder, who, by the way, was represented by their agent, Grandfather. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a handful of CDs devoted to the music of Hoagie Carmichael. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. FBI agent Colleen Rowley met for the second time today with congressional investigators probing intelligence mistakes before September 11th. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Colleen Rowley wrote a letter several weeks ago accusing her superiors in Washington of stalling an investigation shortly before the attacks. The FBI's Minneapolis office wanted a warrant to gather evidence against Zachariah Massawi, who's now charged with seeking to take part in the hijacking plot. But Rowley claims that overly cautious bureau officials refused to help. She gave a copy of her letter to Intelligence Committee investigators. Now she's back in Washington, and the Congressional Intelligence Committee staff is talking to her again. That meeting is private, but on Thursday, Rowley will tell at least some of her story in public. She's scheduled to testify before another committee investigating problems before September 11. In a public hearing, the Senate Judiciary Committee will hear both from Rowley and from FBI Director Robert Mueller, the man to whom she addressed her letter. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
The Islamic Jihad group has claimed responsibility for a car bombing that killed 16 Israelis. The militant Palestinian group said the bombing was deliberately carried out on the 35th anniversary of the 1967 Middle East War. The Israeli army said the bombing took place in the town of Megiddo when a Palestinian driver blew himself up in a car full of explosives next to an Israeli bus. 13 of the bus passengers killed by the blast were reported to be Israeli soldiers. Shortly after the bombing, Israel sent tanks and troops into the West Bank town of Jenin, said to be the bomber's hometown. The Palestinian Authority condemned the bombing, saying it had no advance knowledge of the attack. A top Indian minister says his country is seriously considering military action against Pakistan. Tensions in the region have increased after a failed attempt to get the leaders of both countries to hold face-to-face talks. Veer Singh reports from New Delhi.
Indian Interior Minister L.K. Advani says the international community, particularly the United States, has the power to avert a war between India and Pakistan. In an interview to the Times of London, Advani has said that if Washington could get Islamabad to abandon its own creation, the Taliban, during the U.S.-led war against terrorism, then American diplomats can force Pakistan to stop alleged infiltration by terrorists into Indian territory. Meanwhile, Pakistan has dismissed an Indian proposal for joint patrols along the India-Pakistan frontier in Kashmir. Islamabad says the proposed Indian plan is nothing new and that it is unlikely to work. For NPR News, I'm Veer Singh in New Delhi.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 108 points to close at 9,796. The Nasdaq gained 17. This is NPR News. A federal grand jury in Baltimore has indicted a currency trader on charges of bank fraud stemming from what prosecutors say was an effort to cover up nearly $700 million in trading losses. John Rusnak is accused of trying to hide his losses at All First Financial by forging contracts that insured the bank for the missing money. All First was a subsidiary of Allied Irish Banks. American soccer fans are celebrating the U.S. team's big upset today in the World Cup. Team USA defeated Portugal 3-2 in South Korea. More than 1,000 fans gathered in Columbus, Ohio. Mike Thompson reports from member station WOSU.
The zealous soccer fans waving and wearing American flags got up before dawn to watch the game on 9 televisions next to Columbus's Pro Soccer Stadium. Fans barely had a chance to get settled when they got the chance to celebrate the United States' first goal. Team USA built a 3-goal lead and hung on to beat the 5th-best team in the world.
This is the best thing I've seen for a long time.
I didn't expect this. I just hoped and prayed.
The United States next plays Korea Monday morning at 2:30 local time. Many of the fans who woke up early today promised to do the same next week. For NPR News, I'm Mike Thompson in Columbus.
Magic Johnson became a Hall of Famer today. The former star of the Los Angeles Lakers was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame along with Larry Brown, the coach of the Philadelphia 76ers. Others honored by the Hall of Fame this year included the Harlem Globetrotters and Kay Yao, coach of women's basketball at North Carolina State. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come, at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests Chris and Paul Weitz directed the new film About a Boy, which they adapted from the novel of the same name by Nick Hornby, who also wrote High Fidelity. Time magazine film critic Richard Schickel called About a Boy the smartest, funniest, and most winsome big studio release of this so far dismal year. The brothers seemed like an unlikely pair to take on the sophisticated comedy, since they were best known for directing the teen comedy American Pie. They also wrote the screenplay for the animated film Ants. About a Boy stars Hugh Grant as a single guy living on the royalties of his late father's hit novelty Christmas song. He enjoys the uncommitted life, no job, no family, but he does like having relationships with women as long as they don't require a deep commitment. He's figured out that single mothers are easier to score with. There's less competition from other men, and the mothers are so angry at the men who walked out on them, it's easier to be the good guy by comparison. So he pretends to be a single father, which is his ticket into a single parents group where he hopes to meet women. Here he is at a meeting, putting on his act.
I have a 2-year-old, Ned. He's got blue eyes and sort of sandy-coloured hair, and he's about 2'3". And his mum left.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously it was a very big shock because we were so happy, you know. Sandra's neurology practice was just up and running, and and then one day her bags were packed and my best friend was waiting outside in his Ferrari. Yeah. You know the Modena, the one with the supercharged engine where you can actually see the engine through the back window?
May I ask, does your ex see Ned at all?
Sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Susie.
Susie. She doesn't see much of him, no. No.
How does he cope with that?
You know, he's a very good little boy, very, very brave. They've got amazing resources, don't they? Mm-hmm. Just the other day, I was thinking about my ex, and he came crawling up and put his little pudgy arms around my neck, and he said, "You hang in there, Dad."
God, that's amazing for a 2-year-old.
Is it?
Yeah.
Chris and Paul Weitz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having us.
Is there anything that you related to about the scheme of this single guy to create an imaginary kid so he can make it with single mothers?
The fact that we've done that before.
We're method actors. We're method directors.
Well, I think that that every man at some point or other has come up with some cockamamie scheme to meet women, whether it be a haircut or a much larger kind of con. I suppose I could sympathize with that, but more so with the character who essentially does nothing because he can afford to do nothing, and is trying to occupy his time on the way to the grave as entertainingly as possible.
I think that, I mean, in a larger sense, I certainly can identify with the idea that you pretend to be something before you actually are that thing. I mean, when we first were getting the chance to direct, and we had no idea what we were doing, and we actually didn't pretend all that much. We pretty much told people we didn't know what we were doing. And this is a guy who, he pretends to have a child, and during the course of the movie, actually finds that the one thing that he's pretty good at is being a mentor or a father figure. He's not particularly good at anything else.
Did you read this book when it was first published?
We didn't actually know it. It had already been published for 3 years by the time I got around to reading it, and I read it on vacation, and Paul and I had been looking for a book or a movie idea with a kind of Billy Wilder-esque theme to pursue. And I thought this was the one. Unfortunately, it had already been bought by Robert De Niro's production company, by New Line Studios. So it had been knocking around for a while before we came to it.
And there was another director attached, which was the unfortunate part. And there was another script which had changed the character to be an American living in London. We read it, and we thought that Hugh Grant would be perfect for it because it's supposed to be somebody who's sort of gotten by on their charm through much of their life. And I think you can really believe that with Hugh. And it was also incredibly funny in a very verbal way, and Hugh's great at that kind of thing. So we just sort of hovered around like vultures until the project fell apart, actually.
And how did you convince the people you needed to convince, who I imagine included De Niro's production company and Nick Hornby, the author of the book, that you were the guy?
I don't know that we ever did convince Nick Hornby. So hopefully once he saw the film. No, he's been very kind about the film. And I think that he feels like we were really true to the spirit of the book.
I think that both he and Hugh had their doubts about whether the directors of American Pie could make this kind of book into the kind of movie that it is. I think they were so rabid about getting a chance to do it that eventually they just gave up on trying to put us off.
I mean,
I can understand that they would think that the directors of American Pie are the wrong guys to do this. So what did you do? I mean, did you show up and say, well, we made that movie and it did really well, but that's not who we really are?
Well, not really. I mean, just by being mildly articulate, you know, people are, you get a lot of credit. I mean, the lower the bar is in a certain way, it was as if they were dealing with a talking chimp, you know. the fact that we directed American Pie but, you know, had some degree of sensitivity. I mean, the thing is that our approach to American Pie was pretty much to try to make it as humanistic a telling of that genre piece as possible. We also stuck around. I mean, the project didn't get made for a little while, and I think that we could clearly articulate what we wanted it to be like, which helped the studio get its head around it. I mean, we said we wanted to try to make a movie that is akin to The Apartment, which actually, I mean, the character in The Apartment has a similarly ludicrous scheme to get ahead, which is that he thinks he's going to get ahead in the corporate world by loaning his boss the keys to his flat so his boss can have affairs. You know, not a particularly wise, you know, way of climbing up the corporate ladder. But that's a movie that also has some really dark sort of things happening in the middle of a very funny comedy. So I think that if you're able to articulate the tone of what you're trying to do, then you're ahead of the game.
There's a sequence in About a Boy in which the Hugh Grant character is at the home of a single mother and her 11-year-old son, who kind of wants to adopt Hugh Grant as his father. And she's at the piano playing a song, and she and the boy are singing together with their eyes closed, and the Hugh Grant character is thinking that he just really hates it when people do that whole sincerity thing, singing with their eyes closed. And that's actually a really kind of significant moment in the movie that, like, resonates in ways that I won't explain later on in the film. But I really like that moment a lot. I don't even remember whether it's in the book or not. So maybe you can talk about that scene.
Well, to give credit where it's due, it actually is in the book. I mean, transferring it to the screen in some ways makes it more powerful because you can read the expressions off the actors' faces and it demands less verbal explanation. It is a really important scene to the tone of the film because, there are these very, very deeply sincere people that Hugh Grant's character is dealing with. And Hugh is going through absolute torture, seeing just how, it's a kind of a sing-along moment.
And the song is Killing Me Softly, and I mean, you're very graciously not bringing up the fact that later in the movie, Hugh is put in a position where he has to be equally sincere and sort of, and ends up singing, basically. I think that Hugh Grant's character in the movie has tried to anesthetize himself. He doesn't want to, the conditions of his life can lend themselves to depression. And he's not in America, so he's not on Prozac. He doesn't want to get himself in a situation where things mean things to him. And during the course of this movie, the sort of friendship with this kid ends up meaning a lot to him. But at this point in the movie, when Toni Collette, who plays the mother and the kid, are sort of singing their hearts out around the piano, it terrifies him.
He has a real scorn for sincerity, which the English have in general, the appearance of sincerity. But I think part of that is a fear of deep waters.
The Hugh Grant character has never had to work because he lives off the royalties of his late father's one-hit song. His father was one of these one-hit wonder songwriters. It was a Christmas novelty called...
Santa's Super Sleigh.
Santa's Super Sleigh, yeah. No, that song exists in the book, but you actually had to find a melody for it because it's a movie and people sing it to each other.
Yeah,
we did.
It was written for the movie. There was a great parody show in England called Spitting Image, in which puppets enacted political figures, and they often had great parody songs. So we hired this guy, Pete Brulis, to write the worst possible Christmas jingle ever. I think he did a pretty great job. It's a real standout, disastrous jingle.
And yeah,
would one of you like to sing it?
I don't think either of us would like to.
He goes, "Look who's coming round the bend. It's Santa and his reindeer friends with a ho 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 and a hey hey hey. It's Santa's super sleigh." And Hugh Grant is sort of haunted by this song. He hears it, you know, every November. Basically, it starts to play in supermarkets and in Muzak all over the place, so it really tortures him, although this is how he sort of, you know, pays his bills.
Nick Hornby's novels are filled with pop culture references. He wrote High Fidelity, and even in About a Boy, I mean, one of the ways in which the main character mentors the boy in his life is by giving him the right CDs and buying him the right sneakers, and just a lot of pop culture stuff. How did you find a visual language that you thought would work with the kind of pop style of Nick Hornby's?
For one thing, when you're following Hugh at first, we shot it sort of like a very slick commercial, and the color tone is all blue. And when you're seeing the kid, this camera's fairly static, and there's a lot of sort of warm earth colors. I mean, the other thing
there's a distinction initially between the kinds of worlds in which these two people operate. The first sequence, you never see Hugh's face in the credit sequence. You just see things. We decided his apartment was very much about the things in it, so it's a lot of shots of very glossy, shiny objects that people might like to have. So when we do see him in the trappings of pop culture, it's often in a gigantic record store or a sneaker
store.
Yeah,
in the movie we tried to put him in as many sort of gigantic consumer venues as we possibly could. And the other thing too is that when he buys the kid these sneakers, and then because the kid is dressed horribly by his mother and given a horrible haircut, he buys the kid these sort of cool sneakers. But, I mean, in the usual way you'd handle that, the kid would be transformed and there'd be some sort of, you know, musical montage where he's making the kid look cool. In this version, the kids at the next thing you see is the kid standing barefoot in the rain because the kids at his school have stolen the sneakers that Hugh Grant has given him. I think that going back also to the apartment, there's this fantastic shot of Jack Lemmon at the insurance company where he works, surrounded by tons and tons of uniformed desks. Which is actually, I think, a quote of a film called The Crowd, which is a great silent film about sort of the American dream. But nowadays, I think that, to intellectualize somewhat, we've gone from being a manufacturing culture to a consumer culture. So in this case, we were trying to put him in these sort of gigantic consumer venues that would depersonalize him.
My guests are Chris and Paul Weitz. They directed the new film About a Boy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Chris and Paul Weitz. They directed the new adaptation of Nick Hornby's novel About a Boy. The first movie they directed was the hit teen comedy American Pie, about a group of boys in their senior year of high school who vowed to lose their virginity by the end of the senior prom. The film starred Jason Biggs. Eugene Levy played his well-meaning but clueless father. In this scene, Levy goes into Biggs' room for a father-son talk about the facts of life.
Oh, I almost forgot. I bought some magazines. Do you want to just flip to the center section? Well, this is the female form, and they have focused on the breasts. which are used primarily to feed young infants, and also in foreplay.
Right.
This is Hustler, and this is a much more exotic magazine. Now, they have decided to focus more on the pubic region, the whole groin area.
Uh-huh.
Look at the expression on her face. You see that? See what she's doing? She's kind of looking right into your eyes, saying, "Hey, big boy. Hey, how you doing?" You see?
Right.
Now, you didn't write American Pie. You...
No, I thought it was a wonderful screenplay by Adam Herz, who did indeed grow up in Michigan, and his personal experience was much closer to the experience of those characters than Chris and mine was.
Yeah, no, this is a teen movie about several guys who kind of make this pact that they'll lose their virginity before college, hopefully by the time of the senior prom. And the movie is their adventures in virginity losing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, is that the kind of movie you felt like, yeah, this is it. This is what I really wanted to do?
Well, the thing is, to me, it was a very human contained story. To us, it was about what it was really about was guys going through a rite of passage, not the rite of passage of losing their virginity, but the rite of passage of graduating from high school. And they have this incredibly close friendship, and they all sort of know that they're not really going to be able to be that kind of friends anymore. So in order to not dwell on that, they become obsessed with losing their virginity. I thought it was a terrific thing to try to do as a first film because it benefited from not being particularly pretentious with the camera, and it was really all about the acting. Also that what we were consciously trying to do was to make the film less misogynistic than most of the films of that genre tend to be.
Yeah, I think there are a few genre conventions that we had to satisfy. There have to be some breasts on display at some point or other, and people have to be caught in compromising positions, but that seemed to be the easy thing to do, all the gross-out humor. What felt harder was to portray a kind of updating of certain what had been stereotypes in teen sex comedies, and to realize that a film like Porky's was in fact incredibly misogynistic and ugly, to try to put women a bit more in control of the situations in this film.
I thought it was interesting. Most of the guys in American Pie are actually revealed to be very very vulnerable, even though they're putting on this big front.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's a film where pretty much everybody is trying to be nice to each other. I agree.
I've got to ask you, there's a couple of like gross out kind of scenes in it. And mm-hmm. one of them, like one of the guys needs the bathroom so desperately that he ends up using the ladies' room and he's really got to go. But first, he puts down sheets of toilet paper on the seat.
Yeah,
to keep it clean.
That's the whole thing. Is you try to? I think that certainly gross out humor, but any sort of broad humor becomes neutralized and boring if there's not a lot of character imbued in it. So to me, the fact that this guy can barely make it to the bathroom, but he's so persnickety that he has to lay down paper perfectly before he uses it, made that scene work for me.
Now, I have to ask you about the actual title scene, the pie scene. And for listeners who haven't seen it, a friend who claims to have lost his virginity says, when asked what it feels like, he compares it to the feeling of an apple pie. So the Jason Biggs character tests this out by getting intimate with a pie. And, of course, his father, played by Eugene Levy, walks in as this is happening. What went through your mind in considering how you should shoot that whole sequence?
Well, the first thing that we said to the studio was, look, we're going to be very delicate. It's going to lose the comedy of this if you see too much. And then we got there and we said, what the hell? Let's just shoot as much as we can.
It's not just what the hell. There's actually no way to show someone having sex with a pie without showing someone having sex with a pie. Fortunately, just when we were quailing at the whole thought, our AD had actually worked for the Farrelly brothers before. So he was, he kept us from backing down from the true magnitude of the act itself. I think to us, the important thing was more the interaction between the kid and his father afterwards than the gag itself, which is fairly, if you're willing to do that on film, then you've achieved the strength of that gross out gag. But the more important stuff is that his father is actually willing to cover up for him, and in some ways actually trying to deal with his son's what seems to him is perversion.
The film was interesting in terms of when it came out, because it actually came out right after the Columbine shootings, and so there was the Columbine shootings led to a huge questioning of the role of the R rating in society, and our film got sort of swept up in the question of, you know, should kids be allowed to go see films that are perhaps violent? So to me, the idea that America sweeps in sort of sexuality with violence and lumps them together in terms of how it deals with them in terms of its entertainment was interesting. And in retrospect, you know, the idea that you have this image of American as apple pie, and so I thought there were a few interesting aspects to that being a central image of the film.
What were some of the issues surrounding, like, what kind of rating you wanted to get for the film?
Well, at first we had
an R.
No, well, we wanted an R.
Why did you want an R?
As opposed to an NC-17.
Oh, I see, right, yeah.
We knew that we'd never get a PG-13, just because...
Well, it's about virginity, so how are you going to do that?
Yeah.
It's about sex. But at the same time, we didn't want an NC-17, which is... If you haven't heard of it, it's because films that get an NC-17 rating never get seen.
Mm-hmm.
It's the rating above R, between R and X, and for about four cuts of the film, we were stuck in that kind of middle territory. And, you know, you get involved in these rather bizarre horse trading moments with the MPAA, in which you say, you know, well, I'll take out one F word if you give us this extra thrust on the pie. And so we went through a rather surreal period of watering down the film without watering it down too much.
Chris and Paul Weitz directed the new film about a boy. They also directed American Pie and wrote the screenplay for Ants. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Happiest Baby on the Block, The New Way to Calm Crying and Help Your Baby Sleep Longer by Harvey Karp, M.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews several CDs devoted to the music of Hoagy Carmichael. And we continue our interviews with Chris and Paul Weitz, who directed the new film About a Boy. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with filmmaking brothers Chris and Paul Weitz. They directed the new film About a Boy and co-wrote the screenplay. The movie was adapted from the Nick Hornby novel. The Weitzes also directed American Pie, wrote the screenplay for the animated film Ants, and made their acting debut in the independent film Chuck and Buck. Now, so, you know, your two best-known films are a teen comedy, a teen kind of like sex and gross-out comedy that is much more, I don't know, sensitive is the right word, than a lot of other films in that genre. Mm-hmm. And your other big film is About a Boy, which is a much more kind of like sophisticated, witty story about adults. Compare for us how both of those films were tested and marketed before they were set forth into movie theaters.
The system for testing a film, any studio film, is the same nowadays. There's a research company called NRG, and they run a kind of market testing thing in which you invite what's supposed to be an arbitrarily selected audience to watch the film and grade it. And they have these cards on which they score the film in various ways and list their favorite scenes and the scenes they liked least and that sort of thing. You try as filmmakers to bias the selected audience as much towards your, you know, what you think is your hardcore demographic. So, of course, we only wanted teenagers to come to the American Pie test screening. I think we only wanted bourgeois mid-30s people to come to this one. And then you wait for this score, which is a kind of strange compilation of numbers, and on that score rests to some extent how avidly the studio is going to market your picture, and if you do poorly numerically, people are going to start asking you to monkey around with the film.
And luckily, they both tested really well. I mean, American Pie, you know, it was as if they'd had a religious experience or something, these kids, you know, they'd probably never seen a film before. I think filmmakers tend to fear those events, the test screenings. For us, we were a little lucky because there were a couple of really edgy, you know, comedic things in the film that the studio wasn't so sure would go over. But the test audience sort of singled a couple of those things out.
There were moments where Hugh Grant's character seemed to the studio to be on the verge of detestable, which audiences actually rather enjoyed. So we actually found ourselves benefiting from the process, whereas I think in certain cases it could damage a film, or at least damage the integrity of a film, because you start catering to the imagined sympathies of an imagined audience.
American Pie, which you directed, it was one of the most popular teen comedies of the late 90s. What kind of teen movies did you grow up with? Did you go to the teen movies, or did you just watch, more?
We were watching Bergman in our teens.
Wild Strawberries is hot.
I think. I was mostly about science fiction, Star Wars, the first Star Wars trilogy, which of course was in its own way was a teen movie. Luke Skywalker's kind of space teen. Although I guess less hormonal than Earth teens.
I remember going to see Porky's. I don't remember anything about it.
Did you like it?
As a kid, it didn't really stick with me, so maybe I didn't love it that much.
I liked it a lot at the time. I thought it was, you know, the Second Coming, but
the actors are all in their mid-30s playing 17-year-olds. I think I was frightened by it. But Fast Times at Ridgemont High is a wonderful film that deals from a female point of view with a lot of the issues and is a really funny comedy. And so I think that was more of an influence. And also Fast Times at Ridgemont High introduced a lot of wonderful young actors to the mainstream. So that was also something we were trying to do, is take unknowns and bring them to the fore.
Yeah, I remember seeing Fast Times at Ridgemont High and not understanding why the two cute girls holding surfboards in the ads weren't actually in the film. It was my first experience with disappointment with marketing, because they looked really great. That was a terrific film. Going back to Porky's now, I think, is a pretty mortifying experience, because the actors are in their late 30s to early 40s, have beer bellies, and are losing their hair, and also because the attitude towards women expressed in the script to that film is so odious.
I mean, just to go back to marketing About a Boy, I mean, the thing is, for us, About a Boy is in a lot of ways equally funny to American Pie. It's a different, slightly different tone of humor, but when I'm sitting in the audience for About a Boy, I really hear them laughing a lot. It's a little hard because people are now used to sort of classifying their comedies as romantic comedies, they're sort of teen genre comedies, but they don't really have that kind of category of films that, you know, for instance, Billy Wilder used to make. I mean, occasionally you get one like Jerry Maguire is a wonderful film or As Good As It Gets that actually manages to be a comedy for adults. But I think that it's a real trick as to how to market that kind of film.
How did you start working together?
Let me see. I was living in England. I'd gone to high school and college in England, and I was working as a journalist, and I wasn't doing very well at all.
And his big article was an article where about theater seats in London in movie theaters. So he had to go sit down in like 40 different movie theaters and write about the experience. And then he was I don't know why I'm telling his story, but I'll apotheosize him. He was
I'm not dead
going
yet.
he was going to join the State Department. Actually, he'd come back to America, and he'd lived abroad for much of his life. So he thought, well, hell, I'm going to keep on doing this. And he took an exam for the State Department and passed, and was waiting for a posting. And I, in the meantime, was working at a bookshop and writing plays and bumming off our dad. And I realized that I had to do something eventually to make a living. So Chris and I wrote a screenplay as a gag, and realized that we sort of enjoyed doing it. And then somebody gave us a job to do it. And for a long time, worked very, very happily making a living off things that we didn't get our names on.
What was the screenplay you wrote as a gag?
It was called Legit, and it was about a porno director trying to make his first legit film. And since he doesn't know any real actors, he gets all porn actors to do the part of this sort of art film that this kid has written.
It's actually kind of sweet nature because it's about people who are completely incapable of doing what they're trying to do, who nonetheless, maintain their dreams.
That sounds really funny.
Thank you. I think it was funny. I think it's actually one of the funniest things we've written, but it's it never got anywhere.
You think it still might get produced?
No.
Why?
I don't know. First of all, I'm not sure that a copy is actually extant. We try to look for it every few years, and sometimes it turns up in the back of somebody's closet.
One.
But it's on some ancient computer that has, you know, is in a New Jersey landfill.
We would only do it with actual porn stars, too.
Yeah, I was wondering. You're working together. It sounds like a mother's dream come true, you know. Every mother hopes that their children will actually get along when they become adults, but working together, that's great. Is your mother thrilled that you work together?
I think our parents are thrilled that we work, period, because it was touch and go there for a while. But yeah, they're pleased. It's the opposite of the old Cain and Abel scenario. But she doesn't get to see us in the editing room.
My guests are filmmaking brothers Chris and Paul Weitz. They directed the new film About a Boy and the teen comedy American Pie. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Chris and Paul Weitz. They directed the new movie About a Boy, which is based on the Nick Hornby novel. And they also directed American Pie.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you a little bit about your family. You come from mm-hmm. a really interesting family. Your grandfather was an agent who represented Billy Wilder, who you mm-hmm. referred to, and who else?
William Wyler, John Huston.
Ingmar Bergman.
Charles Bronson, oddly. Pretty much anybody who came into town with a funny accent had to stop at the Paul Kohner Agency and play gin rummy and have apple strudel or something. Our grandfather was, had these great clients. Our grandmother was a Mexican film actress who starred in the first talking picture in Mexico.
And who's on a Mexican stamp, actually.
Wait, I read that she was in the Mexican version of Dracula.
She was, yes. It was shot on the same sets as the Todd Browning version, but from midnight on, after the English language crew had finished their day shooting. It was really a scheme by my grandfather to keep my grandmother in the country because talking pictures had just come around and she had an incredibly thick accent. and what with the end of the silent era, it looked like she wasn't going to get too many more jobs.
So he came up with this game of let's shoot Spanish language versions of American films at night when they're not using the sets.
That was his idea?
Yeah, as a ruse to keep my grandmother from going back to Mexico. Our mother, Susan Conner, was an actress. She was nominated for an Academy Award in a film called Imitation of Life, which is an old Douglas Sirk tearjerker.
Where she plays a very light-skinned African-American woman passing for white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And our dad was a fashion designer. In the 50s, he and I think Hardy Ames and Pierre Cardin, I'm probably leaving out a couple of people, were the first people to put their names on the clothing that they were selling and to make it the whole idea of licensing and of the designer name.
But then he turned basically to writing biographies of prominent Nazis because he had worked in intelligence in the OSS during the Second World War. So we've got a strange family, in other words, to cut a long story short.
So in your family, you had two actresses, an agent, a fashion designer. What was it like when you watched movies with your family? What would they point out to you? What were they looking for?
Really nothing. No. I think they all had their own predilections. My grandfather started out as a producer, so towards the end of his life in his 80s, he decided, I'm going to produce again. So he was really looking for properties to produce.
But in his time, making films was an extension of a larger sense of being cultured, which had to do with literature. And a lot of the great films of his time were made from books.
I think that actually our mother instilled more of a love of the theater. And maybe on our part, as opposed to, I think, most directors who come from a very visual perspective and maybe come up through doing MTV videos or commercials or something, we, like the old filmmakers of the 40s and 30s, were really looking to theater and to the written word a lot more for our inspiration.
What were your teenage years like? Maybe you can compare your teenage years to the teenage years in American Pie. The issues are going to the prom and losing your virginity.
I was in high school in London. There was no such thing as a prom. My school had been in mourning for Queen Victoria for about 100 years. So the uniform was black and gray and white. It was a very different scenario. I don't think I met a girl until I was about 18, and I played a lot of rugby and cricket. So not very similar to American Pie.
Now, you both had parts in the independent film Chuck and Buck, which is kind of nothing like the other films that
Well, it's that nothing like... I mean, it's one of the strangest films ever made, I think.
Yeah.
So it doesn't share much with other movies.
It's very funny, though. I mean... I find it really, really hilarious.
I think part of the reason, part of it for its individuality, is that I don't think anyone involved with the film, except for Miguel Arteta, its director, actually believed it would ever be shown in theaters. And so there was a degree of abandon in some of the performances, mine included, that reflected the fact that we thought it would never be seen. I just remember getting a voicemail from Miguel. Who had previously directed a film called Star Maps, which was an indie hit, saying, would you like to be in a movie? I thought he meant a sort of 10-minute student film. So sight unseen, I accepted a role, which, as I learned on page 70, required me to have sex with a guy on screen. I mean, not for real, of course, but that's certainly the implication. I'd never done anything like that, let alone in front of a camera. So it was a bizarre experience, to say the least.
It was easy for me. I got to play this. Chris's character is stalked by an old childhood friend in the movie, and when Chris rejects him, he sort of turns his affections to this moron, misogynistic actor who I got to play. So it was really fun for me.
And the character who's stalking your brother in it writes a play in which you play the part of the guy who he's stalking, which is your brother. This is confusing to describe, but basically you get to play your brother in a play.
Yeah, exactly. I get to play a moron's version of my brother.
Right, which works because you look like brother. So it,
a little bit, yeah.
even though I didn't realize it when I was watching the movie. So do you think acting helped you as directors?
I mean, the thing about directing actors that's interesting and daunting is that each of them really has their own process. You can't really subject them to the exact same process. I think that we really love working with people who haven't done acting before. So this 11-year-old kid, Nicholas Holt, in About a Boy, has a really huge part and I think does a really lovely job. But that aspect of like, okay, we're going to put on a show. I mean, because Chris and I hadn't acted before we did Chuck and Buck, and a lot of the kids in American Pie hadn't really done much at all. So I think that there is a great precedent for that in sort of Italian neorealist films and French New Wave films. But that's something that's very dear to our heart, the idea that you don't have to be an incredibly trained actor to give a good screen performance.
So do you know what kind of film you will be doing next or that you would like to do next?
Not really. It's going to have to be ambitious, and that I think that that could either be ambitious on the level of just being truthful or ambitious on the level of scope the visual task set before us.
I mean, I think that I've certainly decided that the process of making a film is so incredibly draining that you may as well overreach yourself slightly. Otherwise, you're sort of wasting your time. The last thing we want to do is another version of what we've just done. I can never understand the position of a sort of jobbing director. And fortunately, we don't have to be because we can kind of write to keep body and soul together while we're waiting for the next thing to direct. So it's really hard to say exactly what. I only know it would be interesting if it were some kind of leap in genres. It'd be amazing to do a science fiction film or a thriller. I think the only thing we wouldn't do is an action film, since I think there are enough things blowing up in real life without blowing them up on screen.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
No, thank you very much.
Chris and Paul Weitz directed the new film About a Boy and the teen comedy American Pie.
Your age, that's easier for you to say. Forcing answers into questions and worrying that you might stop breathing. On and on we sift through alphabets of life that never get us anywhere anyway. I'd like you to feel we have the best intentions. I want you to know that I know it's not easy. I want you to know that I know it's not easy, easy, easy. Then there's a bleak human reach out to...
Music from the soundtrack of About a Boy. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews new CDs featuring the music of Hoagy Carmichael. This is Fresh Air. Singer, songwriter, pianist, and memoirist, and screen actor Hoagy Carmichael died in 1981, but this spring he's back in force with a new biography plus three related records. Carmichael is best known as the composer of Stardust and Georgia on My Mind, but he also wrote jazz evergreens like Skylark and Rockin' Chair and movie songs like Hong Kong Blues. His film appearances include To Have and Have Not with Bogart and Bacall and Young Man with a Horn with Kirk Douglas. Jazz critic and Carmichael fan Kevin Whitehead surveys the field.
Washing in a shanty on the shore, the river swinging on by the door. Hear that river lowly calling, eyes a shiver, nights a falling. Hear that river lowly moaning, moaning low.
Bix Beiderbecke on cornet with Hoagy Carmichael on Washboard Blues, 1927. Bix was the early jazz hero whose floating phrases and unusual notes gave his solos a wistful, faraway quality. Early on, Hoagy set out to write the way Bix played. Washboard Blues is a good example, with broad skips more suited to horn than voice, though the tricky parts slow enough so a singer can still sound relaxed. That's almost a requirement with this composer. Hoagy and occasional collaborators, like Johnny Mercer, then wrote suitably evocative lyrics, full of yearning for some idealized or just fondly remembered past. Here's Carmichael in 1956 with a 20s number that sounds like a spoof of pre-Civil War Stephen Foster.
Old rocking chairs got me. Cane by my side. Fetch me that Jensen. For I tan your hide. I can't get from this cabin. I ain't going nowhere, ain't going nowhere. Just set me here grabbing, grabbing at the flies round this rocking chair.
That brand of nostalgia sounds distinctly white Southern to me, and Carmichael did write New Orleans and Memphis in June besides Georgia, but he was a proud son of Bloomington, Indiana. Whether he composed there or in New York or Hollywood later, his songs had an amiable bluesiness as American as corn pudding, if easier on the ears. His voice wasn't much, but by the 40s, it took on the warm, soothing tones of a small-town doctor with competition. As told by Richard Sudhalter in his solid new biography, Stardust Melody, Hoagy was rather cooler up close, but the book's less about dishing dirt than explicating the music in light of the life. Sudhalter's a jazz trumpeter who knows these tunes from the inside. Carmichael got in touch with his inner mensch via sympathetic character sketches like Washboard Blues or Little Old Lady. They gave singers something to dig into besides the usual romantic ups and downs. This is Hot Lips Page, 1938. The lyrics are by Frank Lesser.
Small fry, strutting by the pool room. Small fry, should be in the schoolroom. My, my, put down that cigarette. You ain't a grown-up high and mighty yet. Oh, small fry. Dancing for a penny, small fry, counting up how many. My, my, just listen here to me. You ain't the biggest catfish in the sea. You practice pecking all.
The current boom in Hoagyana owes a lot to his cross-promoting biographer, who's responsible for two tie-in CDs. Sudhalter edited one, an OK collection of 1920s, 30s, and 40s sides from the RCA catalog, including that Washboard Blues and Small Fry, and other covers by Mildred Bailey and Ethel Waters. It's named Stardust Melody after the book, as is another dedicated anthology of new recordings, which Sudhalter produced and plays on. That one features singers Barbara Lee and Bob Durow, among others. It's uneven and sometimes kind of corny, but there is one newly discovered song, the pretty good Big Town Blues. Duro's typically half-spoken delivery owes a bit to our hero.
I ain't got a dime in my pocket, but here's a match that could light the fuse. So here I go, all aglow like a rocket, leaving behind me my big town blues.
There are some better covers on Bill Charlap's new All Carmichael disc on Blue Note. Stardust is built around the pianist's fine trio, with guest shots by guitarist Jim Hall, saxophonist Frank West, and singers Tony Bennett and Shirley Horn. They all understand that with this stuff, it's better you don't get too riled up, but it's almost too quiet. For the man himself, the best thing available is 1956's Hoagie Sings Carmichael, which we heard from earlier and which has some great alto sax playing by Art Pepper. With any luck, this mini revival will prompt someone at Universal to dig up the brisk pop sides Hoagie made for Decca in the 1940s and 50s. There's nothing in the works, but they can always change their minds. Meantime, we'll manage.
I get along without you very well. Of course I do. Except when soft rains fall and drip from leaves, then I recall the thrill of being sheltered in your arms. Of course I do. But I get along without you very well. I've forgotten you just like I should.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Someone's laugh that is the same, but I've forgotten you just like I should. What a guy, what a fool. Think my breaking heart could kid the moon. What's in store? Should I phone once more? No, it's best that I stick to my
support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about covering the war on terrorism with journalist Scott Peterson of the Christian Science Monitor. He's also the paper's Moscow bureau chief and former Middle East correspondent. Recently, he attended a training school for journalists in war zones where he was taught how to deal with kidnappers and gunmen. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.